Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
In this episode of the Scarecast, we will go back to June 2009, when an unidentified man was found deceased on Ross's Point Beach in the west of Ireland, having spent 4 days methodically erasing every trace of who he was. The man checked into a hotel in Sligo under the name Peter Bergman, a name that investigators would discover belonged to no one. Despite a 5-month investigation by the Gardaí, DNA checks, fingerprint searches, and international appeals, no one has ever identified who he truly was. The case is now considered one of Ireland's most haunting unsolved mysteries of all time. And this episode will make you dive into a rabbit hole of mystery. Act 1, The Untraceable Origin. The very first confirmed sighting of the man known as Peter Bergman was at the Ulster Bus Depot in Derry, Northern Ireland, on the afternoon of Friday, June 12, 2009. He was spotted on CCTV between 2:30 and 4 o'clock, carrying a black shoulder bag and a standard carry-on luggage bag. He had spoke to a bus driver and asked if the bus was going to Sligo, and in response, the driver directed him to the Galway Express service. The man arrived at the Sligo bus station at 6:28 p.m. and immediately took a taxi to the town center, a journey that locals note only takes about 10 minutes on foot, suggesting that he may have been unfamiliar with the layout of the town. The taxi driver, who was probably just looking to cash in, first brought him to a guest house, which was apparently fully booked, given it was peak tourist season on a Friday night, before he eventually dropped him off to the Sligo City Hotel on Quay Street. Now, it's important to note that before Bergman was caught on CCTV, no one was able to establish where the man had came from before Derry. His entry into Ireland has never been traced. There is no confirmed airport arrival, no ferry manifest, and no earlier footage of the man. One significant clue is that the Derry City Airport, now known as the City of Derry Airport, operated domestic and European routes, and at the time, certain domestic UK flights did not require full ID checks or passport control. This has led some investigators and online sleuths to theorize that he may have flown into Derry from mainland Britain or continental Europe without leaving a formal record. This theory, however, remains entirely unsupported. Act 2, The Arrival. At the Sligo City Hotel, the man checked in and paid cash for 3 nights, approximately 65 euros per night. He wrote his name in the hotel register as Peter Bergman. He gave a certain home address, which I'll try not to butcher, as Einstetterson, 15-4472, Vienna, Austria. However, there was one problem. This address did not exist. The street name appears in no Austrian or German records, and Vienna postal codes began with the number 1, not 4. So the code 4472 is unassigned. And at no point during the check-in was the man asked for identification, which was standard practice at smaller Irish hotels of the era. Hotel staff and tenants consistently described the man as follows. About 5'10". Slender build with short gray hair, blue eyes, a slightly tan complexion, and he looked to be in his late 50s to early 60s. He had a thick German accent, spoke English well, neatly dressed, clean-shaven, and well-combed. He was wearing a black leather jacket, blue trousers, black leather shoes, blue socks, and a black leather belt, all items from CNA, a major fashion retail chain that operates predominantly in Germany and Austria. Hotel staff assumed that he was some kind of professional worker. He was a frequent smoker and was regularly captured on surveillance footage stepping outside to smoke. Act 3. The 3 days in Sligo. On the morning of Saturday, June 13th at 10:49 a.m., the man walked to the Sligo General Post Office and purchased 8 82-cent stamps and a set of airmail stickers. At that time in Ireland, an 82-cent stamp was the rate for international mail, specifically for letters going outside Ireland to the rest of the world. He was never captured on CCTV actually posting any letters, and no letters or postcards connected to him have ever been found or traced. Detective Inspector Ray Mulderig, who later took on the case, had noted, "Had we had that, the ability to track postings, it is a possibility, and I will stress only a possibility. We might have been able to determine if he posted letters, but we cannot say with certainty that he actually posted 10 letters anywhere." The rest of Saturday involved what appeared to be errands around town, with the man returning to the hotel to eat and smoke, keeping politely to himself. Over the course of his 3 days in Sligo, CCTV captured the man leaving the hotel 13 times, carrying a purple plastic bag that appeared to be full of items. And each time that he returned, the bag would either be folded or empty. The Gardaí concluded that he was disposing of his personal belongings and documents in rubbish bins scattered around town. Critically, the man appeared to have studied and memorized the locations of Sligo's CCTV cameras in advance. His routes were calculated to exploit the blind spots of the surveillance network, and investigators were never able to capture footage of him actually depositing anything in a bin. His movements were described as very meticulous and methodical, as if he knew where to hide his personal belongings that could have identified him. The purple bag itself was also never recovered. On Sunday, June 14th, around 11 to 11:30 a.m., the man left the hotel and went to the town's taxi rank. He asked the driver for a recommendation for a nice, quiet beach where he could swim. The driver suggested Ross's Point, a scenic peninsula about 15 minutes outside Sligo, known for dramatic Atlantic views and a wide sandy shore. The driver took him to the beach, and when they arrived, the man got out of the car and just stood and stared at the ocean for a short time, and then he returned back to the taxi, seemingly satisfied with what he saw. He did not swim. He did not linger. He rode back to Sligo and was dropped off at the bus station, a rather odd visit to the beach. This visit is widely interpreted as a reconnaissance trip. The man was selecting and confirming the location where he intended to pass away. Monday, June 15th was the man's last full day. He checked out of Sligo City Hotel at 1:06 p.m., handing in his room key. His luggage situation had changed significantly. When he arrived on Friday, he had a black shoulder bag and a carry-on bag. Now he only left with the shoulder bag, the purple plastic bag, and a different black luggage bag. The original large carry-on bag that he arrived with was gone, presumably disposed of during his earlier trips around town. He walked from the hotel along Wine Street and Quay Street towards the bus station, stopping briefly in the doorway of the Quayside Shopping Center for just a few minutes, appearing to pause and linger there in a way that suggested that he was hesitating, as if he was internally debating whether to go through with his plan or abandon it. But he did not. He went through with his plan. And it was at 1:38 p.m. that a manager of a bus station cafe claimed that he arrived at the bus station. He ordered a cappuccino and a toasted ham and cheese sandwich. While eating, he pulled pieces of paper from his pocket and looked at them. He read them carefully and then tore the paper in half and threw it in a nearby rubbish bin. Unfortunately, this paper was not recovered. it is widely believed to have been a checklist of things that he needed to accomplish before he ended his life. At 2:20 p.m., he boarded the bus to Ross's Point. Act 4, The Final Hours. Up to 16 people encountered or saw the man on Ross's Point Beach that afternoon and evening. Witnesses described them as jovial, formally dressed, and casually greeting those who walked past him, not acting in obvious distress. He walked the beach for hours, occasionally taking off items of clothing individually. Some witnesses said that he appeared nervous. Others noted that he seemed strangely at peace. The last confirmed sighting of him was at 11:50 p.m., nearly 10 hours after he arrived on the beach. And that following morning, Tuesday, June 16th, at 6:45 a.m., a local man named Arthur Kinsella and his son Brian, who was training for a triathlon, found the body on the shore. Arthur would later describe touching the man's ankle, finding it marble cold. The body was lying face down in the sand beyond the waterline, with no footprints found in the surrounding sand, suggesting that the ocean had carried him in, and the tide has since receded. He was dressed in purple-striped Speedo-type swimming trunks, with his underpants pulled on over the top, and a navy t-shirt tucked into the waistband. An unusual combination that struck investigators immediately. The rest of his clothes were folded nearby on the shore. And it was at 8:10 a.m. that Dr. Valerie McGowan officially pronounced the mysterious man dead. Act 5, The Investigation. Pathologist Clive Kilgallen carried out the postmortem examination, and what he found only deepened the mystery. There was no evidence of classical saltwater drowning. His lungs did not show the water intake that you would expect if he had drowned. And there were no signs of foul play. No wounds, no trauma, nothing to suggest homicide. Instead, the official cause of death was recorded as acute cardiac arrest. And a man whose body showed advanced prostate cancer that had already spread to his bones, lungs, and chest, creating multiple bone tumors and prior ischemic heart disease, with scarring that indicated previous heart attacks. There were other striking details. He had only one kidney. The other had been surgically removed at some earlier point in his life. And yet there was no trace of any medication at all in his system, even though, in the pathologist's opinion, he would have been in significant pain and should have been on strong prescription painkillers. His teeth, however, had told a different story. They were in good condition, the evidence of extensive professional dental work, bridges, root canals, crowns, and a full gold tooth on the upper back right, and a silver filling on the lower left, suggesting someone who at least at one time in their life had access to high-quality health care. Some investigators interpret this as evidence that he deliberately stopped taking medication as part of his preparation. Every single clothing label had been removed from every item of clothing on his body. They had been simply cut away, and in some accounts described as crudely hacked away with scissors. This applied not just to name brand labels, but to all identifying tags, including size and country of origin labels. Investigators threw everything they had at trying to figure out who Peter Bergman really was, and they came up empty. They ran his prints through Irish and international fingerprint databases and got no match. They compared his profile against DNA databases and again found no match. They checked missing person records and found no report from anywhere in the world that fit his age, description, or circumstances. Appeals were placed in European newspapers, especially in Austria and Germany, but no family member, colleague, or friend ever came forward. Even the name he gave, Peter Bergman, led nowhere. No man of that name, of the right age and appearance, could be located in Europe, the Americas, or South America. And after a five-month investigation, his body was buried in an unmarked grave in Sligo. The funeral was attended by exactly four Gardaí. No family, no friends, no one who knew him had came forward. Act 6, The Theories. Theory number 1. The most widely accepted explanation is that this was a planned ending of life by a terminally ill man who knew exactly what he was doing and carefully staged his own disappearance. The man was dying from advanced prostate cancer with serious heart disease on top of that, so he would have understood that he was already near the end. Instead of waiting for a hospital bed or hospice care, he appears to have chosen to control the when, where, and how of his death, and even who he would be in those final days. Everything in those last 4 days point to preparation. That evening, he walked ashore for hours, greeting people, seemingly calm. In near-freezing Atlantic water, with advanced heart disease, it would have not taken much for cold shock and strain to trigger the cardiac arrest that ultimately ended his life. Detective Inspector Ray Muldrig of Sligo has said that he does not believe Sligo was a random choice. As he put it, everything the man did seemed to have a purpose, from the cut clothing labels to the route he took, and if someone simply wanted a scenic place to die, there are countless options along the Irish and Scottish coast to do it. So that raises the question, why this town, this beach, this specific spot? Something, in Muldrig's view, had specifically drew him to Sligo. The deeper question inside this theory isn't just why he passed away, but why he wanted to remain unidentified. There are a few plausible sub-motives that people have suggested. Maybe he had no close family and didn't want to die slowly under observation or to become anyone's burden. Maybe he did have loved ones and he wanted to spare them the social and financial complications of an officially recorded passing by his own will. Especially if a life insurance policy might only pay out if the passing wasn't clearly labeled as such. It's also possible that he had a past that he did not want unearthed after his passing, whether criminal, professional, or deeply personal. Theory number 2. Intelligence operative or spy. One of the more dramatic ideas that keeps coming up online is that he was some kind of intelligence operative or spy. In this version, his background and covert work would explain how he seemed to understand where the cameras in Sligo were, how to move through the town without being fully captured on CCTV, how to strip his life of identifiers, and how he might have managed to enter Ireland without any sort of paper trail. The sense that he already had some working knowledge of Sligo's layout, despite being a total stranger there. Theory number 3. He had a criminal past, organized crime or war crimes. Related to, but distinct from the spy theory, some have proposed that the man was fleeing from or protecting himself from associations of organized crime, possibly a former gangster or someone who had witnessed, participated in, or been involved in a criminal activity who did not want his history exposed upon his death. Now here's a crazy one. There are a small number of internet users that speculate that the entire case was an elaborate performance art project or hoax staged by documentary filmmaker Karan Cassidy, whose 2013 film The Last Days of Peter Bergman became the primary source of public awareness about the case. When asked directly on social media, Cassidy responded immediately, "It's real. Welcome to the rabbit hole." As of 2026, the case remains officially open. The Gardaí maintains that the investigation is currently in sleep mode. When something new comes up or someone credible comes forward, then they'll move the mouse and it'll spring back into action. Well, that's all for today's case. If you enjoyed this case, please subscribe and hit the notification bell, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening to the podcast version of this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. And I would love to hear what you think of this case in the comment section below, or wherever you can send a message. Stay tuned for more content and follow me at The Scarecast on Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, or wherever you are on social media for more updates. As always, be safe out there, and until next time.